You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, welcome to the Orthodox Nationalist. I am Matthew Raphael Johnson, and this is being recorded on September 22nd, 2024. And I'm returning to a topic which I am way too familiar. I've come across a few essays in Russian, and I want to take it from there. And these essays concerned the mythology, specific myths that either the regime, the Ukrainian government, the media, Ukrainian state media, have created over the years concerning Russia and, of course, itself. Many of you know that I have a book, Ukrainian Nationalism, published on Hromada Press and available at Amazon, which deals with a lot of these things in detail without rejecting the legitimate insights of great Ukrainian historians like Doroshenko, and trying to find a middle ground, as Gogol did, between Russian and Ukrainian claims, stressing the unity of the two, but certainly not the identity of the two. The falsification, deliberately, within Ukraine itself, because it's more extreme there than anywhere else, only a small portion of these stories have been adopted by the regime in the U.S. But the, you know, the Ukrainian nationalism is obnoxious because its entire world is anti-Russian, which up until recently was not the general attitude of the population. But because of the one-party state and the complete takeover of the media and education system in Ukraine over the years, the regime in Kiev has made these, or at least most of these, official doctrine. You could be a nationalist and recognize the commonalities between the two countries, as I do. But there's something about the psyche in Kiev that says nationalism must mean that the other, one specific other, is evil, not just wrong. I still think that the majority of Ukrainians are not anti-Russian whatsoever. But there is such a ridiculous contradiction. And first of all, this is a Jewish government who loathes Ukrainians, creating a nationalism that has no connection to historical Ukrainian nationalism, but is being concocted in favor of the Great Reset and the New World Order before it, which is a blatant contradiction. No nationalist of any integrity could ever serve the state in Kiev. And what's happened, and this has gone on for a while with varying degrees of success, it isn't to say that there isn't a common history, but it's not an identical history. It's another thing to say that you have to invent a new one. Ukrainian historians, especially in Ukraine, have resorted not only to, you know, omissions and speculation, but outright lies. And this has gone into high gear since the SMO began in February of 2022. And this is a world created by Ukrainian nationalists of a sort, again, serving internationalism, the intellectual class in Kiev and elsewhere. And these arguments and these claims justify the enmity and their hatred of Russians, cultivating a anti-Russian atmosphere in the country and throwing in prison anyone who doesn't go along. Many of these began in the late 19th century Ukrainian nationalism is a very broad phrase. I certainly believe in the autonomy of Ukraine. So this isn't nationalism in any intellectually defensible sense. It's not to say that you can't bring out the legitimate areas of difference that justify an autonomous existence. But as many authors on my side have said, that these falsifiers, they're not just journalists who are idiots almost by definition, but these are academics. They teach, and whether it be in Ukrainian or in English, they are easy to find. And ultimately, it's an absurd picture. So let me give you a few examples of what I'm talking about. The COVID claim, I'm not saying this is a claim of Doroshenko or Gudashevsky. I respect those men. I've read them endlessly years ago. They don't say a lot of this. This is, you know, official doctrine today. They make a big deal about the Trebilian culture. They talk about the ethnogenesis of Ukraine in the early Middle Ages, that the only, that Kievan Rus is Ukraine, or Rus-Ukraine. And Russia has appropriated wrongly this historical period, that Rus-Ukraine didn't suffer after Batu's invasion, the Mongols, and continued throughout the Galicia-Volhynia Principality, and then Lithuania. And this, according to them, is what made Ukraine a European state, the way they define the term. That Russians are inherently insidious, that the Soviet Union and Russia is the same, which is one of the more offensive ones. They think the phrase Little Russian is shameful. They claim that before Peter the Great, Russians called themselves Muscovites. In other words, only Ukrainians have the right to call themselves Russians, coming from Rus. That Muscovy was originally the hinterland of Ukraine. Ukraine gave it its language and writing. That the Muscovites come from Finno-Ugric tribes, even Mongols. Now, you know my opinion on who the Mongols were. They were not necessarily Asiatic. But beyond that, the modern Russian is a dialect. It's corrupted both by Finno-Ugric and Turkic dialects. That Russia today, to put it simply, Russia preserves the ideology of the Soviet Union, and that Russians in general are absolutely bent on taking Ukraine by any means necessary. That's a general rundown of some of the more silly elements of the official doctrine in Ukraine today. I'm not even saying that these things don't have some truth to them, but not in the sense that many Ukrainian nationalists, such as they are, have. I think Gogol was the Ukrainian nationalist who didn't subscribe to any of this stuff, even Kostomarov. And I deal with these at great length in my book on the topic. So what was the Trapilian culture? Now, I don't claim particular expertise over the ancient pre-literate world, but this is a Neolithic society between 5500 and 2700 BC in southeastern Europe. It started roughly at the Carpathian Mountains to the Dnieper regions to Moldova and even northeastern Romania, maybe 140,000 square miles. It was wealthy, relatively speaking. It was very important. Neolithic is really the term for it, the last one of old Europe. It's the most thriving and populous agricultural community of the Copper Age. Now, the settlements were of small size, concentrated in the Dniester and Dnieper river valleys, but it was the largest settlements in Eurasia, maybe 3,000 structures that have been unearthed. The digging sites were extraordinary. It's older even than those sites found in Mesopotamia. It was an elaborate, artistic society. They had advanced architectural techniques, large buildings, metallurgy, agricultural complexity, and on and on. Well organized. Now, apparently, they had a periodic destruction of settlements, each settlement having a lifetime of roughly 80 years. And no one's quite sure why they burnt these, but there was a site in Romania showing layer after layer after layer of settlements, one on top of another, in fairly rapid succession. Ukrainian Mind says that they are the heirs of the Tripilian culture. Their argument is that it's vaguely, the center of this is vaguely in a lot of Ukraine. And it may well be, you know, one of the first states in human history, which are fourth and third third millennium BC. But after its fall, you have a 3,000 year gap before the settlement of Slavs. You had large waves of migrations, nomadic tribes, each with its own way of life. Trying to connect the ethnogenesis of Ukraine with Tripilia is just, you know, an exaggeration. But Ukrainian as a language and a culture is Slavic. It goes to the Indo-European, not the Tripilian. From the 4th to the 7th centuries AD, there was a Slavic tribe called the Antes, and they were removed from Tripilian land by as much as 3,000 years. So it couldn't have been a significant connection. Some of you are aware of the Kurgan hypothesis, or the notion of a Kurgan culture using burial pits and mounds to be found in the Pontic steppe north of the Black Sea, which is, you know, most likely the speakers of a proto-Indo-European language. It's the Turkish word, Kurgan, which refers to a burial mound. Now, the homeland of the Indo-Europeans is always going to be a matter for debate. You don't have tons and tons of records here. But even if the Indo-Europeans did form a cultural and ethnic community on the territory of today's Ukraine and southern Russia, then, as in the case of Tripilia, the connection could only be ephemeral. This hypothesis was proposed by Maria Gimbutas and Otto Schrader, archaeologists, and is accepted by the scholarly community such as it is. So the ancestral homeland of the Indo-European peoples could have been the territory of Ukraine and South Russia. The assumption is that roughly 7,000 years ago in the Black Sea region, there was a tribe of Indo-Europeans or Proto-Indo-Europeans. Later on, they were termed Aryans, but Aryan is one tribe of Indo-European origin. It's not broad enough. But it disintegrated, and they spread widely across Eurasia. And they were technologically fit. They had wheeled vehicles, domestic horses, etc. And then this laid the foundation for most of the peoples of Europe, and in much of the Middle East, too. But there's no basis for a direct connection. They're searching for a foundation. They do the same with the Aryans, an Indo-Iranian people, even ancient Greeks and Romans using the Black Sea colonies as a center point. I mentioned this in my book, trying to take some truth out of it, but certainly not in the way that a lot of these writers talk about. They even try to connect Ukrainian to Sanskrit to prove the antiquity and the purity of the Ukrainian language. But this argument is a poor one, because the Proto-Indo-Europeans have about the same relation to Ukrainians as they do the Russians, or Albanians, or Germans for that matter. And there's another, which is more Russian-oriented, the Amnaya culture, with which the hypothesis, I mean, a much larger territory in southern Russia. Some of it is in Ukraine. It even goes down to Kazakhstan. But using that culture, you can make the same argument for Russians. Not to mention these are all conditional arguments anyway. But the Yamna or Yamnaya culture, the pit grave culture, is an early Bronze Age society. The southern Bug, the Dniester, Ural rivers, the Pontic Steppe, founded by or discovered by Basil Gorodtsov. And of course, Yama is related to pits. Again, a Kurgan connection. Very similar to the Trapillians. Advanced ceramics, tools, weapons. They were nomads. They had a gerontocracy, but they had wheels and large herds. And they may be one of the final Neolithic cultures that later spread throughout Europe and Central Asia. There's been some genetic studies connecting Yamnaya culture as a genetic mixture between populations related to Eastern European hunter-gatherers and hunter-gatherers from the Caucasus, maybe in equal proportions. So this is the myth of ancient Ukrainian. And one of the discoverers of this, now I'm going to mention names, Tadeusz Szaki, who's Polish, who wrote a book called On the Name Ukraine and the Origin of the Cossacks. It came out in 1801. His hypothesis was that Ukraine comes from a group of people called the Yukurs, largely invented by him. I mean, they were real people, but whose traits were concocted. They allegedly migrated from across the Volga in the 7th century. And the word spelled U-K-H-R-S in English, yet there's some things known about them, but very little. But since the mid-7th century, we're talking AD here, it was the Khazars who ruled the steppes of the southeast. And the Khazars had arrived in this territory a century before. So I don't know what Szaki was talking about. It's just something that came over time. And yet, the Yukurs, the Yukri, and of course clearly he takes the similarity in names and connects them. This was a medieval people, mostly in Germany, in the Yukra River. They were allied with the Polabian tribes, and eventually the Yukurs were assimilated by the Germans. But there's very little known for that very reason. But because of the connection of names, and this is a common pitfall. Because our contemporary names are similar, therefore they must be the same word or the same concept. I come across this all the time. Names change, they change spelling, pronunciation, and sometimes change radically. So these are highly problematic arguments, although they are interesting ones. Because by their very structure, they would have to include Russians. There weren't strict borders back then. One of the big myths getting into the Middle Ages is the myth, as I already mentioned, of Rus-Ukraine. The lands of Kiev and Rus were far larger than what we would call modern Ukraine or the Hetmanate or anything like that. The claim is that in the Kievan era, there was already a self-conscious Ukrainian ethnic group with its own national territory. Certainly there is a sense of Orthodox Slavdom based on language and culture. But to talk about Ukrainians as we talk about them today, back then, is really stretching. And because of that, Ukraine is the only country that can trace its lineage to Kievan Rus, and hence is its successor. So Kievan Rus allegedly developed into Ukraine and was a strong and independent state right up until the 17th century. And then the Muscovites came over and took it over. But in the early period, from the late 9th to the mid-11th centuries, no one could possibly have known that the tribes of Eastern Slavs would form the three main ethnic groups of Russian, Ukrainian, and Belarusian. But the consolidation was going on, associated with the strengthening of the power of the Novgorod world, and then the Kievan prince over all tribes. The cultural community was slowly coming together. But it's very difficult to believe that they were talking about it in those terms back then. the names of some of these Eastern Slavic tribes prior to them becoming what we know today, the Krivichi, the Poljani, many others, they're known from a handful of sources, the two being the Tale of Bygone Years and the Primary Chronicle of Novgorod. But they don't mention Ukraine at all. But Kievan Rus is far bigger than Kiev. It would include Novgorod, Suzdal, Smolensk, Pskov. These were not Ukrainian in the modern sense of the term. I mean, Novgorod was, it couldn't be more Russian than that. It was considered almost the second capital, where the princes Svatoslav, Vladimir, Yaroslav the Wise all reigned there before becoming rulers of the state. The Tale of Bygone Years says that the princely dynasty of the Rurikovich settled in northern Russia, in the area of what would become Novgorod, and only then annexed Kiev and made it the capital of Russia. So in these cases, some of these writers are, and I deal with some of these writers in my book, so it's nothing, should be nothing new to those who have read it. And to think that Kiev by itself arose by itself. No, it arose simultaneously with the northern ones. Archaeologically, you could trace Kiev to the end of the 8th century, not the 5th. You did have some false dating in the late Soviet period. But no mass migration to the population from north to south or the reverse have been recorded during this period. So you can't talk about the northern lands being a colony of Kiev. What I was saying before was, you know, they use the Tale of Bygone Years selectively, like they use most of their sources. This comes from special pleading. But there is a kernel of truth to a lot of this, but probably doesn't say what they want it to say. But the southeast today of modern Ukraine was not a part of Kievan Rus. This was the land of the Khazars, the Polovtsians, and others. But even those territories that coincided with present-day Ukraine, that were part of Kievan Rus, did not have an administrative unity that would distinguish them from the northern regions or the eastern regions. These were the lands of the various Slavic tribes who were eventually subordinated to the princes who came from the north and settled in Kiev. And the settlement of these tribes doesn't correspond with today's borders. You know, the Dravilians lived in the north of present-day Ukraine, southern present-day Belarus. The era of the tribes ended, and then you had consolidation. Today's Ukraine, you have southern Russian principalities. However, the northern borders of these did not coincide with the current northern borders of Ukraine. The word Ukraine, the nature of a separate nation there, is nowhere to be found. There's too many primary sources who describe, like Arabs especially, who talk about the ethnography of the area. They talk about Russia, they talk about Slavia, but not Ukraine. But the ancient Russian state was called Kievan Rus. This is a myth which is found everywhere. This is not specifically an ethno-nationalist myth. Now, for most of us, it's a misconception. You know, a lot of it coming from the imperfection of terminology. But in Ukraine, it becomes a very important part of this mythological psychology. But Kievan Rus, remember, is mostly created in academia, created by later scholars. I use the phrase, of course, as a matter of convenience. But at the time, it was simply called the Russian land, which is, by the way, the subtitle of the chronicle, Tale of Bygone Years. Ruskaya Zemla, in Old Slavonic. Rus was originally the name of the people, or Rusin. Later, the name of the people began to be used as a name of the country. But Kievan Rus, as a phrase, appeared roughly in the middle of the 19th century. It was meant to designate that period where Kiev was the capital of Rus. But of course, it naturally began to be used to designate the Russian state itself. It was a Soviet era where the phrase Kievan Rus became common property. I think it's more accurate, although I probably won't do this, to say Old Russian State or Ancient Rus. It's not just the era of Russian history prior to Peter the Great, but the era from the 9th to the 13th centuries, when Kiev was first the political and ecclesiastical capital to the middle of the 12th century, and then just the ecclesiastical capital until 1299. Now, none of this, by the way, is meant to extol the old Russian state or the Russian ethnicity above anybody else. These were Orthodox Slavs, and everyone was aware of that. The Poles were, the Celts were, but not with the level of detail that early modern peoples had it. Now, you will come across, in tale of bygone years, a few other places, you'll come across the word Ukraine, but a borderland, which is what the word means. Kiev lands were called Ukraine in the days of Kievan Rus. A lot of people quote the tale of bygone years, and in this case, the phrase taken out of context is actually meaningful. There was one section, and I went with my brother and friends to Brest, and Ugrovesk, and Stolp, Kalmov, and all of Ukraine. Now, those settlements that I mentioned are all located on a strip of land on the Polish border. So you're not talking about all of Russia or Ukraine. It was used in all of Ukraine, meaning the outlying territory, the borderland. The toponym Ukraine arose in the 17th century, but it's often used as a not an ethnic designation, but literally as a borderland anywhere. So the documentation from the 12th to the 15th century, the word Ukraine is also applied elsewhere, Pskov, Smolensk, Ryazan. So it's not just in the Ukrainian category. It's used as to describe a borderland of anybody. There's a gospel, a very early gospel in Slavonic, that in the Slavonic says, "And he came into the borders of Judea." This they'll point to and say, "See, Ukraine is mentioned here." The word Pridel, the border, which is a much older phrase, is translated into Ukrainian as Ukraine. It's not uncommon that the words Ukrainian are used. It wasn't an uncommon term. So using it is very dangerous intellectually, because it's not necessarily talking about an ethnic group. Another claim, and I don't want to call this a myth per se, but it's the inhabitants of Northern Rus, or a Russified version of the Finno-Ugric people. Now, the Tale of Bygone Years goes over this at some length. Talk about who paid tribute to the Rus. A long list of people, including Lithuanians and the Mordvins and the Permians. The Slavs settled near Lake Ilmen, called themselves by their name Slavs, and built a city called Novgorod. The Polians and Dravilians had their own principality, etc. And it's very stilted reading, but what it comes down to is that the northern part of Rus, which is certainly not Ukraine, was understood as a territory of northeastern and northwestern Rus, because that's where Novgorod would be. In other words, that the Ukrainian system says that Russians are Russified descendants of the Finno-Ugric tribes, which in and of itself doesn't seem to be a huge problem to me, but then, okay, so they're only part Slavic. But that's not true anyway. Slavs was on the territory of modern Russia long before Kievan Rus, end of the 9th century. The Pskov long barrels culture is an archaeological example and a piece of evidence for it. So by the time Kievan Rus emerged, the Eastern Slavs had already lived in the territory of those Finno-Ugric tribes, and they did coexist with them peacefully. There were twice as many Slavs as the indigenous Finno-Ugric population. The Sloth were engaged in agriculture. The tribesmen, however, were engaged in hunting and fishing. And because they were settled, based on settled agriculture, the Russians could, or the Slavs could, outnumber them. Now, the Tale of Bygone Years talks about who lived north of Kievan Rus. And it's not just the Finnish tribes, the Meria, the Murom, or Muroma, but the Ilmen Slovenes, Beatisi, the Krivichi, more Slavic tribes than anything else. And the Slavs occupied by far a leading role. Now, there is some Finnish blood in Russians, so what? But most of the, like the Murom, the Meri, these Finnic tribes were assimilated by the Slavs. But you see, in Ukraine too, had the admixture of some Turkish blood, even German. But even the Eastern Germans have some Slavic and Baltic admixture. The Celts and the British, and there's so many other examples. Overwhelmingly, of course, Russians are a Slavic background, which no one denies, except for some of these people. But it isn't so much the genetics, it's the existence of a singularity of history, language, national identity. But you get a lot of concern with genetic descent from Ukrainian nationalists of the last 100 years. But northern Russia was purely Slavic, because in a Novgorod area, which never, no one denies was purely Slavic, the birch bark letters are what we would call Old Slavonic. The oldest is from the 11th century, and they're written in Old Slavonic, not Turkic, not Finnish. It would be the Novgorod dialect of the Old Russian language. There have been about 1,000 birch bark letters found in northern Russia, and of the 1,000, roughly 2 are written in any kind of Finnish language. Some of the tribes up there remain. The Muroma, the Melge, maybe they merged. But people like the Mordvins, the Moshkins, the Chud, they haven't gone anywhere. They still exist, and they speak their dialects. For example, the country of Moskel, which was written by V.B. Belinsky, he made the claim that Moscow comes from the Moskel tribe. And that was once described by the Arab traveler Rubruk in the 13th century. But the connection is a problem because the Moskel tribe still exists, and they live in the Volga region. But no matter how you slice it, the Finnic side never predominated. They were never the ethnic majority, which, of course, the Ukrainians try to present. The language of Northern Rus was always Old Russian, which itself developed into Russian, Ukrainian, and Belarusian. It's not to deny the Finnish a certain role. There's nothing wrong with that. But it is doubtless that it's a Slavic society. A long time ago, I got into a fight with some idiot saying that Ukraine, let me put it like this. Yes, of course, Ukraine is older than Russia only in a sense. It's very hard to explain this to somebody because it is, generally speaking, one ethnic group. After the collapse of Kiev and the Tartar invasion, the lands of the Galician-Volhynian principality fell from the rest of Rus and became a part of Lithuania. But the majority of that population, their descendants, was Russian-speaking, and they were always called Russians. I spent quite a bit of time on the Galicia-Volhynia principality, and this is what Doroshenko and Yaroshevsky say Ukraine came from. Not the other stuff I've mentioned. They make the argument that it isn't so much Kiev, but the Galician principality, led by 2 absolutely brilliant leaders, Roman and Daniel. But at least as far as, you know, as far as settlement is concerned, it's very hard to tell who was there first, because the Slavs were everywhere. Now, as they define Ukrainian, of course, it would be older. But that's exactly the problem. They even claim that the inhabitants of Kiev spoke Ukrainian in the Kiev and Rus period, which is, of course, impossible. The language didn't exist. None of the modern living languages existed then. And, of course, any living speech changes over time, although back then much more slowly than it does now. English and Old English. But East Slavic evolved very slowly. And even the Old Russian language itself was not homogeneous. Different regions of Rus spoke all kinds of dialects. And their boundaries didn't follow the boundaries of modern East Slavic languages. Today, I've said this before, one of the more blatant marks of amateurism, in the bad sense of the word, there's a good sense of the word, and special pleading is when they take these much older conceptions and ideas and read them into the modern world. Or the opposite. They take conceptions from the modern world and read them back into the Middle Ages or something. Both are equal errors. On the Ukrainian side, they're doing the former. You had plenty of dialects. You still have dialects. And one of the more noticeable was the one in Novgorod, not in the southern areas. But in that era, it's going to take a lot to convince me that you have Ukrainian, Belarusian, and Russian languages being starkly distinguished from one another. Ukrainian and Belarusian are languages that deserve respect, but they were formed later. And that's because many of these territories in the 14th century fell under the rule of Lithuania. And they eventually purged themselves of Russians, and those Russians came from Galicia, Volhynia. I want to move on to something else. The currency. The current currency of Ukraine is a hryvnia. Ukrainians will spell it with in Latin letters, they'll spell it with an H. Russians will spell it with a G, the G sound. But the hryvnia was the main currency of the old Russian state. It was a silver ingot. Contrary to the Ukrainian claims, the hryvnia was widespread throughout Russia, not just Ukraine. The currency is one way that Kiev tries to make itself distinct. But even that was the currency of Novgorod. And the Russian Pravda actually mentions, and we see it in the Birch Bark letters now, Lithuania used it. Even the Golden Horde used it. But by the 15th century, it fell out of use and it was replaced by the ruble. Again, meaning the same thing, silver. And then from the 17th century on, it was a coin. And it only became the official currency of Ukraine in 1996. And it was ideological, not historical. I mean, for a long time, I believe that the hryvnia was strictly Ukrainian. And it's certainly not the case. And by the way, they divided into kopecks, just like the Russian ruble. There's another claim. Claim that Ukrainians threw off the Mongol-Tartar yoke before the Russians. Why this is important to them, we'll talk about here in a minute. This was done, according to these writers, in 1362. Troops of Lithuania defeated the Golden Horde in the Battle of the Blue Waters, 18 years before the Battle of Kulikovo, and more than a century before the stand on the Ugra. In other words, Ukrainian nationalists, Lipa and people like that, will say that Ukraine was liberated from the Horde, which symbolized slavery, before the Muscovites, and therefore Ukrainians are a freedom-loving people, where Muscovites are lickspittles. And of course, that's very difficult to justify because there was no Ukrainian nation at the time. It was in the process of formation. But talking about the Battle of the Blue Waters is hardly an act of Ukrainian national liberation because the result of this battle was that South Russian lands, Podolia, the southern part, Pereslav, that battle led to the area coming under Lithuanian princes. So they exchanged one ruler for another. And it was the Lithuanian commanders and officer corps that played the dominant role. Grand Duke Olgerd, Prince Kordiat, Alexander, Constantine, Yuri, Fyodor, etc. So that battle against the Horde, who I believe for the most part were Slavs, or at least non-Asians, it transferred very substantial southern Russian regions under Lithuania. The tribute to the Golden Horde did not stop. It resumed at least in the 1370s, because Lithuania entered into alliance with Mamai. There was an order from the Khan, the Golden Horde, to the King of Poland and the Grand Duke of Lithuania from 1392 to 1393, and it's distinctly written, and I'm quoting it directly, having collected the outputs from the Volos subject to us, hand them over to the envoys for delivery to the treasury. Output meaning skimming the cash from the society. So the Horde continued to receive tribute. Didn't even recognize the transfer of these lands to Lithuania. The key elements of the yoke of the Horde in northeast Russia, that is to say Moscow, were liquidated at the same time, if not earlier, than in South Russia. The tax collector was called the Baskak. And their rule in northeast Russia ceased around 1332 because Prince Ivan Kalita received the Yarlik, or an order, or a right, actually, for the Vladimir Principality to collect tribute from Russian lands himself. But the arbitrary replacement of the main Russian ruler, that is Grand Duke of Vladimir, by the Horde, no longer existed. 1327, the last time the Grand Duke was forcibly removed by Horde troops, which was a defeat of the Tver Uprising. And in 1362, which is another version, the Muscovites achieved the transfer of the Yarlik from Suzdal to Moscow under St. Dmitry Donskoy, after which Vladimir became very closely connected with Moscow. Under Dmitry Donskoy, the point of all this is, the tribute payment was suspended. And it actually took place in Lithuania when it did occur. So it's very hard. You can't put a date on for the end of Horde dependence in northeastern Russia. So many areas didn't pay tribute for a long time, and many others only sporadically. Ivan III stopped paying tribute, defeated the Tartars in 1472. You even have, though, individual episodes all over the place of paying them off, even in the 16th century. Another conception is that Daniel Romanovich of Galicia, Volhynia, destroyed the Horde very soon after the Tartar invasion. Rather, Daniel had to go to the Horde in 1245 and acknowledge it. 1254, 1255, he drove the Tartars out of Western Russian lands and part of the Kiev regions without Kiev. But already in 1259, the Horde commander again subjugated the area. And Daniel had to demolish the fortifications. So they paid tribute to the Horde, provided troops and everything else. In Western Russian lands, the Mongols were far less active. But that didn't help Galicia. It was divided between Poland and Lithuania in the 14th century. And we should note that the Tartar invasion had a massive destructive effect in Moscow, but not in southern Rus, in the Kiev region, or Chernigov, or Pereslav. It was southern Rus that was devastated, and that's where the population fled to northeastern Rus and or Galicia-Volhynia, depending, in two different directions. But northern Russian cities were restored right away. The southern Russian cities, however, were not rebuilt. Many were never rebuilt at all. So despite it being extremely devastating to central Russia, of course it was, southern Russia got hit the hardest because it was closer to their zone of entry. So, you know, you take a, it sounds good to mention these myths and these stories, but when you look at them more carefully, you realize that so many of the assumptions, like you could have a date for when the Horde's dependence on the Horde stopped. Well, there is no such thing. That's too simple. So the myth that Daniel threw out the Tartars, hence Ukraine is freedom-loving while Moscow is not, is ridiculous both historically and certainly ideologically. Because even if that's true, it doesn't imply what they want to imply. The claims I already mentioned is the Moscow state is not the successor of ancient Rus. Moscow did derive from Vladimir Suzdal, which was an integral part of Rus in general, Kievan or otherwise. Slavs were there along with Kvitchi and Vyatichi. First millennium, tribes arriving there. But you had refugees, settlers from Pereslav, Kiev, Chernigov, who moved up north from the 11th to the 13th centuries. And many city names, town names in northeastern Rus they repeat the names of the cities of the south, like Pereslav Zelisky, Pereslav Ruski. They keep the names clearly showing where the settlers came from. The other problem is the Moscow princes were descended from Daniel. Daniel Alexandrovich, the son of Alexander Nevsky. But they have a genetic affinity with Daniel and Roman of Galicia too, because those people ended up going to Lithuania. The Galicians, I should say. Daniel, the son of Alexander Nevsky, was a grandson of Vsevolod the Big Nest, who himself was the son of Yuri Dolgorky, who himself was the son of St. Vladimir Monomakh, the grandson of Yaroslav the Wise, and the great-grandson of St. Vladimir. This is where the Moscow dynasty came from. And the very fact that Moscow began to bear the title of Prince of All Russia from a very early time, the time of Simeon the Proud, who was the son of Ivan the First Galita, the grandson of Daniel Alexandrovich. Keep in mind, I'm not talking about Daniel of Galicia here. He was the founder of the Moscow Principality. And I think there's a contract from 1350. It's almost unreadable, but there are pieces that it's Simeon Ivanovich, Prince of All Russia. But you have of all Russia in the charters of Ivan the First Galita, seals from the letters of Simeon the Proud and Dmitry Donskoy, the Treaty of Basel I with his brother Yuri, the treaties of Dmitry Donskoy and Basil II with Novgorod. Yes, these haven't been preserved from the originals, but at least there are places where, and we know certain places where at this early date, these monarchs were calling themselves Prince of All Rus. But it wasn't until Ivan III that it became reliably assigned to Moscow. It's hard to determine it more precisely, though. But the title arose with the same title, the Metropolitans of All Russia. And his blessing was necessary to seal agreements among princes, starting with Dmitry Donskoy, who actively supported Moscow in the matter of unifying All Rus. So the source of the emergence of that formula, of All Russia, chances are, was the Patriarchs of Constantinople, who created that title in the first place. And in their messages to Russian princes, that's exactly what they used. But the Grand Duke of All Russia, that implied the right to the princes of Moscow to all Russian lands, including those especially populated by the Orthodox of Lithuania and Eastern Poland. And this is part of the reason why under Ivan III, the war between Russia and Lithuania began and got very heavy. But it's just the continuation of the policy of Russian unification by Moscow. Moscow did capture Smolensk in 1514 and changed everything. It was a very strategic and wealthy fortress town. And taking Smolensk, it meant that Russia had to be noticed by Europeans. But Moscow state, Moscow Tsardom, you know, these, their use was unofficial going way back, but they were not used when writing the royal title. Usually they use Sovereign Tsar and Grand Duke of all Russia. Another myth, Peter the Great renamed Moscow Russia in 1721, very late in his reign. The claim is, now I've heard this many times, that Peter the First, Peter the Great, changed the name, and that's where we get Russia from. It was called Muscovy prior to that. Well, Russia is a Byzantine transcription of the name Rus, as I've already stated. And you could even look in the Greek, Russia. The word was used in the middle of the 10th century in the works of Emperor Constantine Porphyrogenitus on the governance of the empire in particular. And it was taken from there to refer to the metropolitan, founded at the end of the 10th century. And it was consistently used in Greek. And it was found in the works of Metropolitan St. Cyprian, who ruled from 1375-1406, the Metropolia in Russia. In fact, in his transcription of the latter, St. John of Sinai, he says these books were written in the Studion Monastery by the humble Metropolitan Cyprian of Kiev and all Russia. I shouldn't say written, they were transcribed there. But Russia, eventually, by the 15th century, was assigned to Russian lands that were united into a single state. Only Ivan IV in 1547 did it get official status, but it was well known prior to that. Mid-17th century, the modern spelling, Russia, began, and it was actually the reunification of Ukraine with Russia. It was in a charter to the Moldovan voivod Stephen Batory. The title was used, Great Sovereign Tsar and Grand Duke Alexei Mihailovich of All Great and Little Russia Autocrat. Now that title in those details were used then for the first time, but variations that had been around long before then. Now Moscow was first mentioned in the Chronicles in 1147. The principality, in other words, the state, came into existence roughly in 1265. But even principality is late in Russian, the end of the 14th century. State, too, meaning state as in government. But even in that era, it wasn't called Muscovy. And not even the Moscow principality, it was the Moscow land, Rus or Russian land. Especially in 1310s, 1320s, where the princes of Moscow became princes of Vladimir. And going back to both the metropolitans and early rulers like Simeon the Proud, every once in a while you come across Muscovy used by foreigners. But Muscovy began to be widely used in early 16th century. And that really comes from Polish propaganda. Since Poland was struggling against the Russian monarchy. A writer in 1517, Michalski, who wrote the Treatise on Two Sarmatias, he argued that Russia was the territory of Galicia with its capital, Lvov, which itself at the time was under Polish rule. But they cite this guy, and yet they do it only arbitrarily. They say, in Muscovy there is one speech and one language, namely Russian or Slavic, in all satrapies and principalities. Mikovsky failed to consistently maintain the line that Muscovy is not Russia. And it really was because of Mikovsky's work, the reach that Poland had in Europe at the time, that's when Muscovy, as a word or a country name, took root in the Western European press. But like in the Holy Roman Empire, the name Muscovy coexisted with Russia or Russia. Heinrich Staden, who was somewhat of an adventurer, wrote his book Moskauer Land. In Russia, the Grand Dukes, in the city of Moscow. He uses the name Russia throughout. Staden uses the word Muscovy only in the sense of the city, not of the state. And don't forget Notes on Muscovy by Sigmund von Herberstein. And he says, Russia is now ruled by three sovereigns. The greater part of it belongs to the Prince of Moscow. The second is the Grand Duke of Lithuania. And the third is the King of Poland, who now rules both Poland and Lithuania. I want to quote someone else, a mercenary captain named Jacques Margaret, He was around roughly during the time of Troubles, and he thought it was an error to refer to Russia as Muscovy. And I'm going to quote him at length here. "It is a mistake to call them Muscovites and not Russians, as not only we who live at a distance do, but also their closer neighbors. They themselves, when asked what nation they are, answer Rusak, that is Russians. And if they are asked where they're from, they answer Moskva or Vologda, Ryazan. Muscovites can be called inhabitants of only one city. It is the same as if all French began to be called Parisians for the reason that Paris is the capital of the Kingdom of France. And even then, with greater reason, since Paris has been the capital from time immemorial, and Moscow has been so only for 100 or 200 years. Also, the abbreviated title of their sovereign, Tsar of all Russia, which should, properly speaking, be understood as King, Lord, and Grand Duke of us, all Russians, or of all Russia, can be understood this way, but not Muscovites or Muscovy." So the myth Muscovy and Russia are two completely different things, and one was stolen from the other, that really didn't take root even in Europe. It had a brief appearance, but Muscovy was used either to designate the capital or a large part of that region under the Grand Duke. Now, the royal title of the Muscovite sovereigns was not recognized by Poland or the Vatican, but the Ottoman Empire recognized it immediately. Now, to the concept of colonization, that is, that Ukraine was a colony of the Russian Empire. Well, Russia had no colonies, possibly the exception maybe of Alaska, or even they had a fortress in Hawaii in the first half of the 19th century. But Ukraine was not a colony, de facto or de jure. After all, the Cossack state of Khmelnytsky joined Russia voluntarily and was autonomous for more than 50 years. Peter, a very different kind of Russian, used the betrayal of Hetman Mazepa, we talked about last week, as the excuse to incorporate Ukraine into the structure of Russia. Russia meaning the Russian Empire. In 1708, the first division of Russia into provinces, the Kievan province, was formed on Ukrainian lands, the status of which didn't differ from any place else. Ukrainian Cossacks became Russian Cossacks. The Cossack nobility, the Russian nobility, not anything lower than that. That's impossible with a colonial administration. The inhabitants of a colony would be second or third class subjects, very limited in their rights. But the Russian Empire, even more than all this, Ukrainians were disproportionately involved in the rule of either Moscow or St. Petersburg. So many, going way back, were either of Ukrainian or Cossack origin. Now, I'm willing to say that Ukraine was a colony in the Soviet era. I mean, Ukraine had not as much autonomy as Georgia or Armenia did in the Soviet Union. You had at least two dictators from Ukraine in Moscow, Chernyenko before him. Actually three, Khrushchev, Brezhnev, and Chernyenko. But I'm willing to say because of the tremendous exploitation, although I've also argued for the Petrine exploitation of Ukraine, but it doesn't give Ukraine a specifically colonial status. And while I'm at it, I should mention something I briefly mentioned in The Third Rome, my very first book, something called the Valuyev Circular. So the Russian Minister of Internal Affairs, Peter Valuyev, in 1863, banned the publication of Ukrainian books. And the theory goes, he argued that there was no separate little Russian language, there is not one, and there cannot be one. Now, there's more to this story, because the Valuyev Circular is used to prove the persecution of the Ukrainian language in Russia. Someone I've quoted on here before, Orest Subtelny, Ukrainian author from Canada, he said, "In July 1863, the Minister of Internal Affairs, Peter Valuyev, issued a secret circular banning Ukrainian scientific, religious, and especially pedagogical publications. Only works of art were allowed to be printed in the Little Russian dialect. Valuyev declared that the Ukrainian language never existed, does not exist, and cannot exist." Now, Valuyev never said that. Let me quote directly from the circular. And this comes up all the time. This was a fairly lengthy essay. Bayou have said this. The very question of the usefulness and possibility of using this dialect in schools has not only not been resolved, but even the raising of this question has been received by the majority of Little Russians with indignation, often expressed in the press. They very thoroughly proved that there was no special Little Russian language, is not and cannot be, and that their dialect used by the common people is the same Russian language, only spoiled by the influence of Poland. That the common Russian language is as understandable for Little Russians as Great Russians, and even much more understandable than the so-called Ukrainian language now being invented for them by some Little Russians, and especially the Poles. The majority of Little Russians themselves reproach the members of that circle, trying to prove the opposite with separatist plans hostile to Russia and disastrous for Little Russia. The phenomenon is all the more regrettable and worthy of attention because it coincides with the political plans of the Poles and almost owes its origin to them, judging by the manuscripts submitted to the censors and by the fact that the majority of Little Russian works actually come from the Poles. So if you're going to quote him as saying there was no special Little Russian language, there is not and cannot be, that's not his opinion. He's quoting the majority of Little Russians, and he claims they're indignant at the idea that there's a separate Ukrainian language somehow outside of the Russian civilization. Books in the Ukrainian language were banned. That is simply not true. I'm going to quote him even more here. Taking into account, on the one hand, the present alarming state of society, agitated by political events, and on the other hand, bearing in mind that the question of teaching literacy in local dialects has not yet received the final resolution by law, the Minister of Internal Affairs considered it necessary, pending an agreement with the Minister of Public Education, the Chief of the Holy Synod, the Chief of the Police, regarding the printing of books in the Little Russian language, to issue an order to the censorship department that only such works in this language that belong to the realm of essays and critiques would be permitted for printing, and the passage of books in the Little Russian language, both the spiritual content and educational and generally intended for the initial reading of the people, would be suspended. This order was submitted to the Supreme Sovereign Emperor's attention, and His Majesty was pleased to grant it by royal approval. In other words, it was permitted to publish works of art. The only things that were prohibited were spiritual and educational books. Understand, though, why this was done. The Polish uprising in 1863, as poor as it was, did worry the Russians. But the Poles, the Masonic clique that wanted independent Poland, the Petersburg bureaucracy very much underestimated them. Valuyev's circular existed only as an attack on separatists associated with the Poles, and not against Ukrainians as such. And more interesting aspects is the Petersburg press, which was very liberal, spoke out against it, but the press in Kiev supported it. The intellectuals of Kiev thought that the circular was worthwhile. But by the early 1870s, it effectively no longer was implemented or really enforced. More famously is the Ems Decree of Alexander II in 1876. It was very similar, which prohibited publication of educational literature but fiction in the Little Russian dialect. But fiction was again permitted a few years later. In 1876, the Russian government was still concerned about the separatist aspirations of some, a minority, of Ukrainian educators. And they were sporadically enforced. But in no way can you call these the persecution of the Ukrainian language. Yes, it did limit the publication of literature in that dialect, but there was never any complete ban. And keep in mind, too, outside of the Polish issue, that the Ukrainian dialect was not yet recognized as a separate language at the time by anyone. The Russian Empire didn't prohibit literature and recognize languages of the national minorities, you know, Finns, Armenians, Georgians. And speaking of the Ukrainian language, it is, as we all know, closely related to Russian. I've mentioned the Ukrainian claim, or their nationalist claim, Kievan claim, that Russian has an admixture of Finnish. But that has not been confirmed by any serious linguistic research. No one denies that Russian is Slavic. Clearly, the East Slavic language group, Russian and Ukrainian, are a part of it. You know, no one denies this. It is true, and this is not just linguistically, but politically. Going back to Kievan Rus, Russian and Ukrainian were essentially the dialects of the same language. But when Kiev fell to the Mongols in the 13th century, all Russia was split up, and that's when dialects became more distinct. The Russian language was influenced by Old Slavonic, but Ukrainian didn't derive from that. It mostly was a spoken vernacular coming from the Grand Duchy of Lithuania, the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. So the Ukrainian language became heavily influenced by Polish, as most of you know, adopted many words into its vocabulary. Same thing under Peter the Great. Many French words and a handful of German were brought into Russian. Now, the normal claim is that Russian and Ukrainian share about 60 to 65% lexical similarity. It means that 62% of their vocabulary are words with similar meaning and form. English and German share about a 60% similarity. So it's not incredibly close. Now, Ukrainian has an 84% similarity with Belarusian, 70% with Polish, and 66% with Slovak. But the dissimilarity can be explained both by different influences, Russia's connection to Old Church Slavonic, and Ukraine's link to the local vernacular after the fall of Kievan Rus. But this isn't all that interesting. At the time we're talking about in the 19th century backwards, there was no standardized Ukrainian language. So they're talking about Russian and Ukraine today in 2024. But remember, a language is not merely vocabulary, but by grammar, mechanisms of constructing phrases and sentences properly versus improperly. Because even if one language borrows a lot of vocabulary from another, the grammar is going to remain the same. About 55% of English words are borrowed from French and Latin. Despite that fact, English is still a Germanic language. The English language has many borrowings, the influence of Normandy and France in the Middle Ages. We have the same thing with the Balkan Language Union, including representatives of all the language groups down there, but there's a surprising number of similarities in vocabulary. But it didn't mean that these languages were not separate. But to claim that there was this massive Finno-Ugric influence on Russian is incorrect. I didn't find learning Russian was very easy to slip into Ukrainian. Of course, there's plenty of distinguishing features. And it can be difficult to go one from another. But this doesn't mean that they're not closely related languages. So let me summarize this, and I know at parts it can be confusing. And it's confusing partly because there is a little bit of truth to the Ukrainian claims. But today, we could summarize them that the Kievan mind after the revolution of both 2004 and 2014, the regime in Kiev sees Ukraine as inherently Western. That's a natural state of its psyche, coming from a lot of these myths. And if you reject that, you are a supporter of Putin and the Soviets. A lot of negative stereotypes of Russia. That Russian civilization came from others. The Mongols, the Vikings, whoever. That the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth is a kingdom of freedom and democracy. There's even people who claim that Russia wants World War III to save the ruble. That all Russians are inherently Bolsheviks. They actually believe, and the press says, that Putin wants to capture everyone and make them slaves. Apparently there's no slavery in Crimea. Muscovites come from the Mongol Tartars, but nationalists in Ukraine have no problem with the Crimean Tartars, the Bashkirs, and etc. They hate Russia, but Mongolia, and Tartarstan, and Karelia, not a problem. That Russians worship Putin as a god. And they can't seem to make up their mind on that. Either they hate him or they love him. Well, if they're anti-freedom in the Ukrainian mind, they must love him. But the Russian people have no influence over anything, and everything is controlled personally by Putin, that he does evil consciously. They really believe, and have been spreading this, that Russia wants to attack Lvov and move on to Poland. For some reason, this vulgar nationalism can't distinguish between old imperialism, like the Ottoman Empire or whatever, British, and the imperialism that derives from Western capitalism, the rule of secret elites, transnational cartels, a handful of bankers, people of BlackRock. They start believing their own nonsense. They join the Eurasian Union, they're going to be impoverished, despite the fact that Ukraine has no functional economy today. The old myth that Russia is based on oil wealth, which is utter nonsense. I've written about this. Canada is more exposed to oil risk than Russia is. Norway is the fifth most oil-dependent country in the world. Russia isn't even in the top 20. Saudi Arabia is less dependent on oil than Norway is, and about the same as Denmark. India, Belgium, the Netherlands are more dependent on oil production than Russia. Now, how you define oil? The World Bank, you know, doesn't have Russia in its top 20, I should say. But how you define oil, is it the oil industry? Is it all hydrocarbons? You know, this is a particularly obnoxious myth. The Russian economy is the closest thing to autarkic as you can get. There's no connection between Russian economic fortunes and the price of oil. And the same goes for the stability of the ruble or interest rates. Anyway, I've gone on long enough in dealing with some of the myths that Ukrainians believe about Russia then and now. I recommend reading Gerasevsky or Doroshenko. These were very interesting writers, and they represent the defensible concept of Ukrainian nationalism. What I'm talking about here is the political or rhetorical conception promoted by the Kievan revolutionaries. I don't believe they believe them, but this is what's being promoted, and this is what's part of what's keeping this war going. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.